Welcome to episode 15 of the Word Theater Podcast, your weekly access to the world's finest short stories, recorded live in Los Angeles, New York, and London. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner. This is the fifth week of our seven-week celebration of Joyce Carol Oates' stories. And today's story is called Running. I have recently learned that the author is a lifelong runner who can hardly go a day without putting feet to pavement.
In an article on writers who run in Outside Magazine, Joyce is quoted saying, "In running, the mind flies with the body. The mysterious efflorescence of language seems to pulse in the brain, in rhythm with our feet and the swinging of our arms. The structural problems I set for myself in writing, in a long, snarled, frustrating, and sometimes despairing morning of work, for instance, I can usually unsnarl by running in the afternoon."
Please welcome a great actress who has long been a part of the Word Theatre family, Maggie Siff.
Reading this story through for the first time, I noticed that it only has four sentences and that one of them lasts for six pages. It felt a little daunting, but as I read it out loud, it became clear that the rhythm of the story is the rhythm of a run. My job was simply to settle into the kind of stream of conscious meditation that happens naturally while running, with the rising and falling of the breath. You see clearly how the mind can begin to look at things that have been pushed aside. Random thoughts can move into focus and demand attention. Joyce Carol Oates is deep. It was a wonderful experience meeting her and reading this story. I hope you'll enjoy listening to Running.
Here is what happened. Except, of course, nothing happened. Their third day out, they went running along a hiking trail beside Lake Mount Moriah in the northeastern corner of the Adirondack Forest Preserve, running at a moderate speed, not pushing themselves, for they were not serious or obsessed runners, not marathon runners. Neither, in fact, had been athletic or much interested in competitive sports in adolescence. She, a slender, dark-haired woman in her early 30s, he, a tall, big-boned, silvery blonde man a few years older. And she was running ahead, since the trail was too narrow for them to run comfortably side by side. And he had to stop to retie a shoelace. He murmured, "Damn," though good-naturedly. For he was a good-natured man. And she ran on, retaining her speed. She was in excellent spirits, as she often was at such times. Sacred times, they seemed to her. The ease of running, the childlike pleasure, the illusion of being weightless, bodiless, without a name, as if only at such moments the physical being propelled through space, the soul, assuming there was a soul, defines itself. This is happiness, my truest self. And she was relieved that the sky had cleared. No rain clouds. It was a windy, sunny, brightly cool August morning, a day of aching beauty. The previous day, they'd driven too long, and much of the time in pelting rain, the close confinement in the car that, while technically his, they shared on ambitious drives. So the mere fact of a clear sky was a simple fact of happiness. She was one to be grateful for such things. And the sharp fragrance of the pine needles underfoot, and Lake Mount Moriah, one of the region's numerous glacier lakes that the evening before checking into their motel they'd hardly been able to make out in the dusk, was so luminous as to seem unreal. A lake out of a dream, reflecting as in a polished metallic surface the sculpted sky and the dark serrated rim of trees, evergreens, birches that surrounded it. She felt the blood beating hard and exuberant in her veins. "I can do anything. I need no one." And turning a corner, she emerged into a grassy clearing of boulders, gigantic boulders that looked as if they were pushing up from the earth, covered like a man's beard and deeply creased like human faces, compressed and distorted. And the wind In the topmost branches of the trees was visible here the effort, the seeming emotion. The trail divided into a broad, not very clearly defined V, the left branch curving back to the lake in the deep shadow of evergreens, and the right branch, beyond several more boulders, into an unexpected meadow of tall grasses. Queen Anne's lace, milkweed gone to seed, dazzling goldenrod, how beautiful. And if no one saw it? And she seemed not to hesitate, not even for a fraction of a second. It was as if gravity drew her to the right branch of the trail and away from the lake. She was not thinking, how will he know which way I've gone? Nor was she thinking, will he be puzzled, concerned, not knowing which way I've gone? For she was a woman of moods and impulses and spontaneity. That was one of the ways which, in the human world, she defined herself and was defined, and she was curious, following the trail upward through the meadow, wondering where it would lead, guessing that shortly it would loop back to the lake, or if it did not, and he didn't seem to be following her, she would turn back, return to the lakeshore trail, catch up with him from behind. As she sometimes did, she would surprise him, playfully approaching him from behind. Here I am. Did you wonder where I was? She was beginning to sweat inside her clothes. Her khaki shorts, loose-fitting white shirt, a gauzy maroon-orange scarf tying her hair back from her face. But it was a good feeling, yes. And the mild ache of her muscles, the calm, hard, defiant beat of her heart. She was thinking, with pleasure, too, of returning to the motel room and showering, and they would have their late breakfast. The routines of their lives together were comforting, yes, but they were confining, too. Predictable and confining. Are we addicted? To what are we addicted? Thinking that they were a couple well-matched, companionable, though not married, they'd been together for nearly 4 years, and though they lived at least much of the time, as on this 8-day drive through the Adirondacks, for instance, but often they traveled separately, as if they were married. Yes, and married for years, casual acquaintances assumed they were a married couple, for there was between them an unstudied ease, a companionable cheerfulness, a manner suggesting familiar marital customs exercised without self-consciousness or much emotion, for they were professional people. She, an administrator at a public school district, he, an engineer at one of the Bell Laboratories, yes, but she wanted to return to graduate school and get another degree in comparative literature, perhaps. And he was, in his heart, a purely theoretical mathematician. She was thinking how strange it was, how simple a fact, yet how strange that he was the man who loved her and whom, of all men, she loved. How strange that they might be defined in that way. And in another era, her mother's era, for instance, they would have been married years ago, would have children, a child, at least. And if so, who would that child be? For she had had an abortion once, and this was a secret from him. This was always to be a secret from him, as from her family. She told herself, it matters to no one if it doesn't matter to me, and it doesn't matter to me. In truth, she rarely thought of it. She never thought of it. She was not that terrified girl of 19, though terror surfaced in her sometimes, not that terror, but another. She did not believe there was any connection. The girl of 19 was vanished, forgotten. She could not remember the boy's face, and he was not a man, but a boy, her own age. But she knew she had not loved him, or if she had loved him, it had been a mistake, just as, perhaps, the love she felt for the man who was not her husband was a mistake. A sickness of a kind, a sickness that had no name, because she feared losing him. He was so good-natured, so kindly, so loyal. He was a man of temperate desires and ambitions, a man so reliable, having no idea of the hunger she felt for him, her secret terror of being left by him, her terror that he should know, she'd even suspect, though he was a man without suspicion, that she did fear losing him that sometimes the terror woke her from her sleep, her heart pounding. Erratically, a taste of something brackish at the back of her mouth, while beside her, unknowing, the man who was not her husband slept his heavy, healthy sleep. Drawing his deep, rhythmic breaths, undisturbed, yes, and had not one of her dream terrors wakened her only a few mornings ago back in the city, the anticipation of this trip into the mountains perhaps had dislodged the terror, but of course she hid it from him. She shared everything with him by day, but really she shared very little with him. This, too, he did not know. He could not guess how by day, especially when she was running, she felt angry contempt for that other woman, that sick woman, that coward who was, yet was not, herself. For she was a wholly free agent, a woman with a career, an only moderately paying career. But a career, nonetheless. She was economically independent of any man, as her mother and her mother's female relatives had not been. Why then did her mother express such worry about her, such disapproval, as though reluctant to bring up the subject again, having once murmured, "If you love each other, I don't see why." Meaning, "I don't see why you don't get married," her voice trailing off into painful silence, for there was no reply, only a stiffening of her daughter's shoulders, an angry hurt glistening in the eyes. And so now, running, hearing the high wind in the trees, or was it voices? Faint laughter. She told herself, defiantly, that she was not really certain, not really, that she loved him. This man with whom she lived, who was not her husband. Apart from the hunger that bound her to him, she did not know if she loved him or could love any man. Though knowing that however much she did or did not love him, his feeling for her was less intense than hers for him, less desperate, less hungry, and this was a fact about which she did not care to think, for it pained her. It was a hurt lodged deep in her. And in any case, this was not the time for such thoughts. The happiness of this moment, flying weightless and bodiless and nameless along the trail that had now grown weedy, thinking, how different everything is by day. Meaning, how different I am by day. She was a strong woman, really. Buoyed by joy and defiance in equal measure, running now along what appeared to be a parkland access road into which the hiking trail had invisibly merged, Lake Mount Moriah behind her, and to the left, this road with a look of being abandoned, densely bordered by deciduous trees, many of them birches, striking clumps of birches with thick, sturdy, white, glaring trunks, very different from the smaller birches downstate. She saw that some of their leaves had turned prematurely yellow, wizened, the symptoms she'd read in an Adirondack publication of stress caused by acid rain, pollution out of Chicago and its industrial environs blown eastward to fall as poisonous rain in the Adirondack wilderness. She wanted to cry with rage. She was so furious. She was deeply wounded. One day, she would break off her relationship with the man who is not her husband. Precisely because he was not her husband, and she did not sense her need for him, her terrible hunger, how it demeaned her. When they returned to the city, perhaps, she was an independent woman. She was an ambitious woman, yes. She was willing to move to another part of the country, and she was willing to move alone. You don't love me as much as I love you, and so I hate you. But of course, she did not hate him. She loved him very much, unless that was simply her weakness, that love to which of him she could never speak, and thinking of these things, vexed, disturbed, thinking of the very things she forbade herself to think of at this sacred time, this running time, this time of namelessness and flight and happiness, she drew back one hand across her forehead to wipe away the sweat. Her scarf was damp. She heard laughter ringing on all sides, blinking to get her vision clear. She saw ahead Several figures by the side of the road, young men, they appeared to be in their mid or late 20s, campers perhaps, hikers. They were dressed in shorts or swimming trunks, bare-chested. They were talking and laughing loudly together, and then noticing her, they quieted at once. The high-pitched laughter of one fading, as turning, he squinted in her direction to see what his companions had sighted. She would remember the sudden silence, and how, instinctively, hardly conscious of what she did, she glanced about to see if there were other figures close by, female figures. But there did not appear to be. She felt a stab of apprehension, thinking, but I can't turn back, I won't turn back, trying not to meet the men's frank, rude, assessing gazes, for she was not the kind of woman who anticipates harm from strangers, not at such a time. In a place of such natural beauty, not here, not now. So she continued, running along the road, the sun pounding at her temples, rivulets of chill sweat running down her sides. She did not consider herself a sexually attractive woman. She was several years older than these young men, and once they got a clear look at her, they would lose interest in her, she believed. Her small, wan face, her overlarge, intense eyes, her sensitive skin exaggerated any blemish, her narrow lips, small breasts. She told herself, even as running toward them required to pass within a few yards of them, since the trail led inexorably that way, and to pause, to turn, to veer off suddenly in any other direction would be to acknowledge to the men and to herself that there was something between them to be acknowledged. She saw that they were staring with an unmistakable excitement, conferring together. One of them, thick-bodied, squat, his bare torso covered in coarse black hair, had already stepped quickly out into the road as if to block her way. How very quickly he'd moved. By instinct, perhaps sheer masculine instinct, the predator's instinct, yet still tasting panic now. She continued to run forward. I can't stop. How can I stop? I will not. She saw that one of the men had a growth of pale red whiskers, another grinning, had fleshy lips. The one blocking her way was misshapen somehow. Was he? A blunt, hairless bullet head growing out of his shoulders, no neck, fatty, muscular upper arms, rolls of pale flesh at his stomach, the waist of his swimming trunks low enough to show his navel, a thickly whorled navel with dark hair. She saw his eyes, hot, derisive, hungry. In terror, she was telling them, I am not my body, I am more than a woman's body, seeing the expectancy and arousal in their eyes, the crude appetite. The elation, how like dogs' mouths, their grinning mouths, the teeth inside their grins. Don't touch me, any of you, God damn it! Her vision blurred with tears of fury and helplessness and resignation as she ran into harsh sunlight, as into oblivion, and then so unexpectedly, she would recall afterwards, so miraculously. When she was within approximately 20 feet of the fattish young man blocking her way, she saw how the expressions on the men's faces shifted, their eyes moving quicksilver in their sockets, their bodies too altering, almost imperceptibly but unmistakably. They'd sighted someone or something behind her. In that instant, she understood that the man who was not her husband, and who did not love her with quite the hunger with which she loved him, must have run into view. He'd known which branch of the trail to take. To follow her. Very likely he'd been watching her all along. And so everything was changed. I'm safe. Saved. As if the very sun had been extinguished, and had then returned, and all so instantaneously, not a molecule in all of nature would register its unthinkable absence, let alone its miraculous return. She was safe. She was loved. Not on her own terms, but on another's. And this would be the terms of her life. These were the terms of her life. Her eyes welled with tears that, undeserving as she was safe. And there remained no sign anyone might interpret to suggest that she had ever for even the space of a minute, not been safe. For perhaps she had imagined everything? She had exaggerated the danger? For now the young men showed friendly faces, still watchful, but smiling, glancing from her to the man who ran behind her, judging, yes, this was a couple, the woman was under the protection of the man. Yes, they understood. Nothing required articulation. For instinct prevailed, instinct is all. The young man with the reddish beard lifted a hand in greeting. The fattish young man blocking her way was no longer blocking her way. He stepped off the road, mock graciously, with a friendly smirk, even as maintaining her speed, her face showing none of the emotion she felt. She too stepped off the road on the other side, running in the grass to avoid him, courtesy in her gesture as well as caution. And then she'd passed him and the others, and saw ahead only the narrow road, the intermittent blaze of goldenrod, the dense border of trees, and the sky, a high, remote blue marbled with cloud, the thin tracery of white that scarcely moves, like a frieze. And behind, she heard men exchange greetings. The man who was not her husband, and the young men by the road, the ritual of murmured greetings common to joggers, hikers, bicyclists of our time. Hello, how's it going? And no replies expected. And so that was what happened. Except what had happened.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Maggie Siff reading Running by Joyce Carol Oates. This story originally appeared in the Ontario Review in 1992.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Please tell your friends about the Word Theatre Short Story Podcast and visit wordtheatre.com, where you can support us by becoming a member so you don't miss any of our live Zoom performances. You can also pick up books there from our partner, bookshop.org.
Special thanks to Joyce Carol Oates and her entire team for their support of Word Theatre, to Jonathan Sachs, who composed our theme music, and to Joseph Cho, our technical director. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
And I'm Kirsty Peard in England. Until next week, signing off.